This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Just over half of all Americans say they support the death penalty, though support for capital punishment is close to its lowest levels in decades. Support for the death penalty has ebbed and flowed over time. Seth Koch looked at the way it's been viewed in this state. His new book is called Lethal State, A History of the Death Penalty in North Carolina. Seth Koch is a professor of American Studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and he joins us now. Seth, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about this book and what got you started even looking into this.
I was interested in the death penalty because of the apparent lack of interest in it, because of the stagnation in people's support for it, the steadiness of support for it, and because it seemed like this hugely important moral decision that a state, whether it's North Carolina or any other, or a community would make, that seemed to happen in darkness and without a good deal of discussion. And so I wanted to provide a little bit of light.
We're in an interesting state right now. Whenever we talk about the death penalty, we talk about this de facto moratorium, the last execution, 2006, 142 people in the state of North Carolina on death row. But through a series, and maybe I'll ask you to start with where we are now, and then we'll work back, a series of legal complications, and as you say, perhaps a bit of moral ambiguity, we're stalled.
Sure, we're absolutely stalled. And as a historian, my disclaimer here is that I'm not supposed to know anything about the present. So when people write in correcting me, just don't forward those emails. But we have a few things going on in the state right now that, yes, have meant we have not had an execution since 2006. First of all, we had the Racial Justice Act passed in 2009 that has since been vetoed. But what that did was say that prisoners on death row who could demonstrate statistical evidence of racial bias in the death penalty in North Carolina had a shot at a commutation, a reduction in their sentence from death to life without parole. And there's ample evidence of that racial bias. And so a number of prisoners were removed from death row. They've since been put back on, but there are some claims out there that need adjudication before we can start executing again. The state medical board also said that they would punish physicians who participated in executions. That's required by law. Since then, the General Assembly has prohibited them from punishing physicians. The General Assembly has also tried to sort of make it easier for medical professionals to participate in executions, but the state board still says that's an ethical violation. And on top of that, there's been a lawsuit filed by death row inmates who are making the case that lethal injection violates their Eighth Amendment protection against cruel punishment. We've seen a lot of news recently about the experience of lethal injection and what it does to a body, and their claim is that while that punishment may look quiet and calm, what's happening in their bodies or what will happen in their bodies isn't. So we're very much tangled up right now, and it's not at all clear whether those tangles will be untied anytime soon.
And it's not just a legal tangle as well. We seem to be equally divided. Was it always this way? Were people pretty sure? How far back do we go? Maybe the question is, when did the death penalty start in either the state or the colony of North Carolina?
Sure. I mean, it starts as soon as we get here. We don't even have a North Carolina when the Carolina colony begins executing people. And the first person that we're aware of who, or we have a record of being executed, was a Native American person. So we start right away targeting minority populations with the death penalty. It continues well into statehood, peaks in the 1930s, and sort of starts a decline around World War II until it sort of surges back after the Civil Rights Movement in the 1980s and the 1990s.
Can you tell what's involved in these ebbs and flows of public opinion around the death penalty?
It's really hard to tell. And one of the strange things about the death penalty, if that's the right way to put it, is that in raw numbers, the numbers of people being executed are actually fairly low in comparison to the number of people who are being imprisoned, for example. So a year where we might hit a peak of the number of executions in the state, say in 1938, I believe we have between 12 and 15 executions. That's doubling or tripling an average per year number. But that's not a large number of people if this is the way that we're going to evaluate its impact. But we do have fear of crime in the 1930s around bootlegging and prohibition. We've got unrest in the 1940s around the World War II. Before then, we have peaks in executions that seem to ride alongside peaks in lynchings in the 1880s and the 1890s. So it's hard to explain why one person is executed and why one isn't unless you look at the details of each individual case, which often involve lots of very detailed examinations of their personal histories of the crime that they were convicted of, etc.
Capital punishment is clearly a difficult moral question. When you talk about capital punishment in general, the question about whether the state ever has the right to take a human life, and then, of course, the way it is unequally distributed across our state and in our penal system, it is very clear that racial bias plays a role in I don't think there's any question anymore. You were reluctant at first to make the connection between lynching and the death penalty, and then ultimately you say you were more or less forced to make the connection. Tell us about that.
Yeah, the connection's impossible to ignore, and I think that I was concerned that in making that connection I would be accused of some kind of hystericism about the death penalty. But I think it's important to listen to the voices of the people who appear in these histories. You tell us very clearly that there was a relationship between lynching and the death penalty. We see references to the term legal lynching used in newspapers in the 19th century, particularly black-owned and published newspapers who were very clear on the use of the death penalty. When 80% of people in a state where the African-American population doesn't exceed 35% are people who are being executed, then you have a racially disproportionate punishment. But lynching was in North Carolina, and we have a minimum of 175 documented lynchings between the end of the Civil War and the 1940s in North Carolina. So that's fewer than executions. We've got about 362 executions, but a number that is approaching. It's a demand for an institutional space to harm and kill black people. And the court system responded to that demand. Sometimes it responded very directly. There was a case in 1928 when there was a black man accused of raping a white girl. That's an incendiary claim at the time. This is a time also when a conviction of first-degree rape would have meant a mandatory death sentence. We have a mandatory death sentence for first-degree murder, rape, burglary, and arson during much of this period. A mob forms in the courtroom, attacks the defendant. The judge draws a pistol, fires into the ceiling, points the gun at the mob, and tells them he will kill them if they touch the defendant. The trial is finished with the state militia there with bayoneted rifles. And when a death sentence is handed down, the judge in the case says, this was the right way to do things. There's a right way and a wrong way to go about this, and we went about it the right way here. And what we're hearing there is not only the judge saying to the mob, we listened to you, but also saying publicly that the outcome, which is the execution of an African-American man for a crime against a white person, the outcome is less important than the process. And the process here followed the rules that we're accustomed to. Now, those rules excluded black people from serving on juries. Those rules made it difficult for public defenders to defend their clients. Those rules made it difficult for African-American attorneys to represent clients. But as long as the rules weren't the mob, we could accept the outcome.
You have this veneer of the rule of law, and of course, so, and talk more about the way it's misapplied again across racial lines. Not just that a disproportionate number of black people are executed, but also the way in which juries and the courts viewed crimes between members of the black community punished unequally versus cross-racial crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. As I said, most people executed in the state were African-American men with white victims. Crimes that took place between African-American people, whether it was the murder of an African-American woman by her spouse or other such crimes, were treated with less seriousness. And this was true not just of capital crimes, such as murder. This is true of other kinds of crimes. And there's a history of African-American leaders in their communities asking the white heads of their towns or their states for a more interventionist policing, asking to be policed more. And sometimes when those police arrived, they behaved in exactly the kinds of ways we might expect in this context, with police violence and other mistreatment. But those communities were aware of their sort of tenuous relationship with the state and town governments, and they wanted help. And when they got it, it wasn't always helpful.
There, you mentioned a minute ago mandatory death sentences, which at one time even include for crimes like burglary. But that also had a kind of a converse impact or a perverse impact on outcomes. Talk about mandatory sentencing when it came to capital punishment.
Yeah, sure. I think one of the most important things to know about it is that it resulted in a lot of commutations. We have sort of an unsustainable number of death sentences, and so governors routinely commute people who receive these mandatory death sentences. I think one of the best examples of this taking place that also tells us a little something about lynching took place in 1925. There was a sanitarium outside of Asheville where people might go to sort of take the air if they were unwell, and a janitor there named Alvin Mansell was working one afternoon. A woman was selling flowers. She was later raped, crawled to the home of someone living in the area, and reported the crime to sheriff's deputies. When she reported the crime, she said that her assailant was a light-skinned, middle-aged African-American man. I'm sorry, a dark-skinned, middle-aged African-American man. Alvin Mansell was arrested. He is a 17-year-old light-skinned African-American youth. And to most people at the time, he did not appear to be the person who had been identified by the victim. She identifies him in the courtroom. Before his trial even takes place, there is a lynching attempt, but he has been secreted away to Charlotte by the local sheriffs. This happened fairly frequently. He's brought back to Asheville for his trial. As I said, he's identified in the courtroom, and he is given that mandatory death sentence as a 17-year-old sent to death row in Central Prison in Raleigh. The next day, letters pour into the governor's office, including from the victim in question, saying, listen, there's a consensus that he didn't do this. We think that the death sentence in this case was great. It sent the right message. Now let's just commute him. Now, lest we pat ourselves in the back too much, more letters came in defense of the members of the lynch mob who had been arrested following their attack on the jail. But Alvin Mansell is commuted. And when I first learned about him, I didn't have access to some of the digital resources that are available now through newspapers.com and ancestry.com. And I'm a bad researcher, so I couldn't find anything about him. But he turns up later in the census as one of a number of African-American men between the ages of 18 and 40, all living together in a residence in rural North Carolina, which I could surmise was a prison camp. And by the early 1930s, though, he's working at a bakery near his hometown in Pickens, South Carolina, with someone with his same last name. Someone with his name and his date of birth and place of birth later turns up in a middle-class African-American neighborhood in Connecticut. And I find his death certificate. And he died in that neighborhood in Connecticut in 2001. And the last listed occupation he had was as a doorman at the United Nations building. So this is someone who survived a lynching attempt. He survived a death sentence, and he went on to live what was a functional life. But he followed a familiar path to people who were subjected to that kind of violence, which is that he left the South and ended his life in somewhere where he could work and start a family.
What about the trajectory of governors who are commuting these sentences? Was it as politically incendiary always as it is now?
Absolutely not. It was really a political non-issue, as best I could tell. Now, people certainly had an interest in pardons and that they would write to governors and request them or write to them and say that they shouldn't pardon someone. There is a robust pardon industry of attorneys offering their services to lean on the scales for one prisoner or another. And I'm not aware of any in North Carolina, but we know, of course, infamously about the blues musician Leadbelly, who wrote a song called A Pardon from Governor Neff or something like that and received that pardon in exchange for his musical labor. But there doesn't appear to have been a political cost. And the death penalty, in part because there is a consensus that we wanted it in one form or another, even if we were kind of fudging on how it happened, there does not appear to have been a real political value to it until after the 1970s, when our politics sort of start to change and the death penalty becomes clustered up with these other kind of social issues, right? It becomes a question of how we want our society to function. Then it becomes political, and you see people such as the then Governor Bill Clinton flying home to personally decide whether or not to commute someone's sentence, and others issuing stern denials of sentences when mercy may have been appropriate.
Yeah, it's another piece of evidence how racialized the death penalty is in our entire penal system, is that precisely as we move into the era of identity politics, when criminalization, particularly in black neighborhoods, when that begins to change, that's when we care most about the death penalty politically. So another piece of evidence. And in this state, interesting, you talked about the repeal of the Racial Justice Act, which took place at the minute that was one of the first things the Republicans, Tom Goolsbee was the senator who was in charge of overturning that. And again, just ignoring the evidence that this is a racially charged. So in the debates now over time, was this much of the discussion? It certainly is now. And as you say, beyond the 70s, was this much? And clearly in the black press, it was always an issue. They understood what was going on here. Was this much of a when it was a political issue, was race a big part of it?
Race was a part of it. And one of the interesting, if I can use that word, parts of this story is the sort of consistency of the criticism of the death penalty, in that we have columnists in the News and Observer, even as they're publishing on their front page shockingly racist depictions of African-American people involved in death row cases, that we have on their page four these very reserved columns calling the death penalty uncivilized, saying it's unchristian, saying it's barbaric, and pointing out that its burden falls disproportionately heavily on African-American people. Paul Green, actually the playwright who we're fond of here in Chapel Hill, advocated generally and specifically against the death penalty, and often talked about how it was basically a tax paid by uneducated African-American men experiencing poverty. And it was not even an open secret. It was just out in the open that that's the way that it happened. And the question was, does this evidence of racial bias allow us to make a decision about the death penalty. And we've made that decision by not making it, by allowing it to sort of expire, at least temporarily.
But the examples, and you have many of them in your book, and I would like you to talk about at least one more. Take us back to 1944, a case of Ernest Brooks Jr.
You know what? I'll do you one better and take you forward to 1948, because I think this case particularly illustrates how juries functioned and really the story behind racial bias in the death penalty, setting aside the sort of horrific numbers and setting aside the way in which these men were described, is jury composition. That for the most part, these African-American men are being sentenced to death, are convicted by all-white juries. So in 1948, there's an African-American man named Raleigh Speller from Bertie County, which at the time is about 60% African-American. And he receives a death sentence for first-degree rape with a white victim from an all-white jury. And his attorneys take that case forward to the North Carolina Supreme Court three times, actually. And it actually reaches the United States Supreme Court. And they're arguing that this is an unconstitutional violation of his due process because he has not been tried by a jury of his peers. And the county clerk of Bertie County testifies and describes the process that they used in Bertie County to ensure a fair count. Now, people who might serve in a jury pool, that's the big group of people who come in and get winnowed down to the jury, they have to be taxpayers. So it's already likely that they're property owners, which is what they'd be paying tax on. So they're less likely to be women. They're less likely to be African-American people because of the demographics at the time. But there's a possibility that you would have African-Americans in the jury pool, particularly if 60% of the county's African-American. So what they do is they take all the eligible jurors' names and write them on pieces of paper, and they put them in this very complicated box, which has all sorts of sections and locks and flaps. The box is locked by the sheriff. The sheriff takes the key, locks it in the drawer in his office, locks the office. When the time comes, the sheriff opens his door, opens the drawer, retrieves the box. The box is brought into the courtroom, and a child of no more than 12 years of age is blindfolded, escorted to the box, draws names from the box. And are you going to be the person who calls this child a racist for making white juries? No. This is what my legal colleagues would say is a facially neutral way of selecting juries. But what the clerk of court testified is that when you saw the name of an African-American person drawn from the box, it was written in red ink. And the name of a white person is written in black ink. And when a name written in red ink is pulled from the box, they are struck for low, insufficient intelligence or low moral character. And you don't have to demonstrate that. You can just strike from the jury. And what that clerk of court said was that in his approximately 20 years of service in Bertie County, there had never been an African-American person in a jury pool, let alone in the jury. And the United States Supreme Court rejected the appeal, and Raleigh Speller was executed.
And as you say, things have not really changed in terms of the only thing that's changed is this sort of de facto moratorium. We're not doing it now, but none of the rules have changed. And even the ability to demonstrate how race plays a part was taken away by the legislature because, of course, you'd prove it.
Yeah, I think the story of the modern death penalty in a way is we have this period, first of all, in North Carolina when we're not executing anyone. We just stop. Juries stop handing down death sentences. So that lasts from about 1961 to 1984. And what happens in between then is a case called Furman v. Georgia in 1972. And the United States Supreme Court says American states are doing this wrong, unconstitutionally wrong. Mm. And it's this hugely long and complex decision, one of the longest ever written. Everyone writes their opinion. But Furman kind of leaves the window open. And the result is what we have now is this bifurcated system. So the system has changed. But interestingly, Furman was an acknowledgement of the role of race. It basically said your likelihood of being executed in this country is about the same as being struck by lightning. But the predictor of whether or not you get struck by lightning is your race. And so we have that out in the open, but we don't address it as directly as we might. Instead, we sort of find ways around it. And the result is that we have this shaky consensus that we believe that people who are so-called the worst of the worst should die in prison. And the question is, does the state intervene and execute them before they reach the end of their life due to the conditions of their imprisonment?
Seth Koch, professor of American Studies at UNC Chapel Hill, author of Lethal State, A History of the Death Penalty in North Carolina. Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You can find links to the book at our website, stateofthings.org.